From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guest this week is Barry Day. He is the editor of The World of Raymond Chandler in His Own Words. It's a sort of Bartlett's quotations in which all of the quotes are from Raymond Chandler, but it's also a biography of the great author of crime literature. Barry Day has also edited similar books about Dorothy Parker and Noel Coward and has written about Oscar Wilde, P.G. Wodehouse, and Rogerson Hart. Barry Day, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. Good to be there.
I enjoyed your book very much. I was just the other day looking in the New York Times Book Review, and they called your book terrific, but they also said something odd in the first paragraph of the review, in which they said that Chandler was a great artist who left behind no great art, and that his novels are stale and don't hold up. What did you think of that?
Well, I think that's overstating it. I mean, I think to a degree there's a point there. None of the books are that satisfactory, and he didn't think they were either. But as he often said, I don't really care about plot or character. I care about the language, the words, the music. And in fact, that's I think why many people can come back to him again and again, because his use of language is far, far better than almost anybody who wrote in that genre.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, it's kind of like Ian Fleming in a way, in that it doesn't really matter what the plot is about as long as it's an enjoyable ride.
Yes, well, I mean, he said, because don't forget, this man was born in Chicago, educated, brought to England as a very young boy, educated at English public school, which says a great deal in itself, and then came back to America and had to learn, as he said, he had to learn American like a foreign language. So he brought with him a kind of academic classical education, looking at this language, looking at a form of literature that was pretty crude, but as he said, it was about the only honest writing he could find, and he wanted to try and see if he could do that. And I think he certainly did, or we wouldn't be talking about him.
Well, even today, I think people look at crime or mysteries or whatever, thrillers, whatever you want to call them, as lesser literature. And I think one of his goals was to elevate the genre.
Indeed. And, of course, the other thing he said, in the UK, I'm an author. In the US, just a mystery writer. But then when he died, his obituary in the Times of London said that in working in the common vein of crime fiction, he mined the gold of literature. So that's his view, and that's the view of quite a lot of people, I think, would share that view. He did do something with the form. He also said, I never can quite understand why Americans don't see the very strong element of burlesque in what I write. Or maybe it's just the intellectuals. Because if you look at a lot of his words, they're funny.
Yes.
When he creates these exaggerated similes, and he says, oh, he was as unobtrusive as a tarantula on a slice of angel food cake. Well, it's extreme language, but it's funny. And that humor he injected into it has not always been seen by everybody who read it.
Well, I always laugh out loud, and I certainly did when I was reading your book, The World of Raymond Chandler in His Own Words, because there were so many of them in a row that were so great. Like, in the first place, I don't like drunks. In the second place, I don't like people getting drunk in here. And in the third place, I don't like drunks in the first place.
That's right. Yeah. Indeed. And, of course, what he also then did, because he was a very private man, somebody said about him, in fact, it was John Houseman, the producer who worked with him on The Blue Dahlia, and he'd been to English public school too, and he said, in life, Chandler was too inhibited to be gay, too emotional to be witty. The system had left a sexually devastating mark on him, and I think it had. He was a curmudgeon when he was drunk, pretty well silent when he was sober, which wasn't all that often towards the end, and he would insult you to make sure that he got the word in first, before you could judge him and reject him, he would reject you, be it a studio or an individual. He was a crusty gentleman, I think, and probably a very sad one.
You think he was a sad person?
I do. I mean, he had this strange background, came back to the States after the First World War. He then married a woman 18 years older than him. He didn't realize it was that big a gap at the time. And they were happily married for 30 or 32 years, I think. And when she died, he said, I lived a posthumous life after that for the next 5-6 years, and the drink had taken over by this time. And yes, he just was not a happy man.
Although Playback, which is his last published novel, is not one of his most popular novels, I've always loved it a lot. And I think you can really see a sadness in that particular book.
I think you can. And I think also his doppelganger, if you want to call it that, Marlowe, echoes his life to an amazing degree. This is what he would like to be like. He'd like to be the wisecrack wherever possible, as Marlowe says. He'd like to be able to solve the problem, go through, get beaten up, come out the other side, a knight with not much armor, but an unbreakable spirit. And then in later life, as Chandler gets sadder and, you know, more and more ill as he was, Marlowe changes too. And later on, Chandler realized that. He said, I made him into a Christ figure. I didn't intend that. So he lived his life in a way through his creation.
We're talking with Barry Day, and his new book is called The World of Raymond Chandler, in his own words. And it's a remarkable book, Barry Day. How did you go about assembling? I mean, I guess you've done it before for Dorothy Parker and some others. But how did you do it? What's your method? Do you have all these quotes all cut out on little pieces of paper and assemble them?
You do as you go through, yes. First of all, you read all the things there are to read, the novels, the short stories, and you see the themes, which you go in knowing pretty well. It's going to be about dames. It's going to be about Los Angeles as a character, Hollywood and so on. And then you go to all the letters that he wrote. And don't forget, towards the end of his life, when he was tailing off in fiction, he was writing endless letters. Somebody called them the Conversations of a Lonely Man. He writes people he hardly knew, and he thought some of his best writing was in that, and said to his English publisher, I've got copies of them all, maybe one day you'd like to publish them. Well, they never did in his lifetime, but they have done several times since in different collections. So I just go through it, cluster the material according to the themes, and sometimes a theme will come out you hadn't thought of. And so then you've got that. Well, having done that, you've learned a lot of it. So then you go through it and link it. What my function in these things is to present the writer and his work and to give enough linkage so that the context is clear, rather than so many biographies of Chandler, or indeed anybody else, are so personal to the writer. He or she injects themselves into that life. And I don't think that's what it's for. I deal with Noel Coward a great deal too. I've done about a dozen books on Coward, including his letters.
Yes.
And you simply present them and link them so that people can read through it without, you know, too much trouble, I hope.
Well, you know, both of those personalities are very strong personalities, Raymond Chandler and Noel Coward. Can you compare and contrast them a little for us?
The contrast is that Chandler was an internal, lonely, bitter person in many ways. He said, I sometimes think I am really not a pleasant man around, and maybe some of the things I write indicates that. Coward was a very outgoing, created a persona for himself. So in many ways, they were total opposites. They never met, to my knowledge, and I doubt they would have got on. Chandler would have felt that Coward was putting him down because of the brittle wit that he would have used on the subject, and Coward would have thought this man was rather boring, I think. But the very strange thing, I found out only the other day, they both died on March the 26th, years apart. Now, is there any significance in that? Probably not, but it just struck me, having worked with both of them for a long, long time, I hadn't realized that.
Died on the same day, but years apart. Well, I remember Noel Coward's death, which was sometime
1973.
Yes, and Chandler died in 59 or something?
59, yeah. They're quite different people in many ways, but they also have that insight and that use of language, which to me is the thing that sets a writer apart. Can he play the music? And they both could.
And both wrote screenplays.
Yes, they did. Coward wrote about four. In fact, we're going to publish three of them next year. Chandler, when he first came over to the studio Paramount, he was working with a young Billy Wilder, who said he had no idea of construction, He had no idea of a screenplay, but he could write a great line. He said, "There's nothing as empty as an empty swimming pool." That is a great line. Chandler himself felt that probably the screenplay was the one American-shaped form of art that would last, but he hated the things he saw people doing with it. And he said, "You know, you have to accept the fact that most of what you write will be cut, because it can be done better by the camera or by the actors," he said, "but it has to be there in the first place." And he learned that many, many cases the words had to go. He said, "The best short scene I ever wrote was with a girl who says, 'uh-huh,' in three different intonations." Hmm. He said, and it did the whole thing, just did that. Didn't need any more explanation. So he learned a lot from it. He moaned and groaned about it. He said, "If my books had been any better, I wouldn't have gone to Hollywood. If it had been any worse, they wouldn't have asked me." So he was torn about the whole experience. But at the end of it, he said, "I really enjoyed it. You know, there was something about it. I personally had a lot of fun there." Well, you never thought so from what he said about it at the time. But his other good line, I think, about Hollywood was, "Anyone who doesn't love Hollywood is either crazy or sober."
Now, he worked with some interesting people. He worked with Billy Wilder, but also Hitchcock.
Yes, he didn't enjoy that too much. Hitchcock hired him to write the screenplay for Strangers on a Train, and he did. And then Hitchcock totally ignored it, fired him, and took on another writer. And Chandler's explanation was, "Look, he does what he calls suspense. I don't understand that. I'm trying to write about people and situations and character. We just didn't get on." He said, "But he never actually spoke to me about it. I just heard I'd been fired." The other interesting thing, I think, about Hollywood with him was when they were doing The Big Sleep, Howard Hawks. Chandler wasn't involved in that. He was doing another film. But this is the thing about the plotting of his books being somewhat shaky at times. Howard Hawks, who was writing this thing with William Faulkner and a couple of others, cables Chandler one day and says, "Who killed the chauffeur?" And Chandler cables back, "No idea." It didn't matter to him, but the words that he used did.
Well, now, can you account for that by saying that The Big Sleep is, I believe it's two short stories that he kind of...
Three,
that he kind of shoved together to make a novel? That some of the strains of the stories were lost in that way?
Could well be, yes, because, I mean, he began by writing the short stories, and he was getting a cent a word for it, so it wasn't exactly overpaid. And then Alfred Knopf, the publisher, said to him, "Why don't you make a novel?" So he took those stories and, as you say, kind of cobbled them together. I think it's very readable, but as I say, the words count for me much more than the plot.
What do you think is his best novel?
I think, in a funny way, The Long Goodbye, which was not quite the last one, but the last real one, I think. And he said, "I wrote that, probably my best work, I wrote that watching my wife die by half inches." Hmm. So he really couldn't do much more after that. I think Sissy's death in 54, I think it was, really destroyed him. I mean, he then went to his other mistress, The Bottle. Well, he had two mistresses, really, The Bottle and Los Angeles. And he fell out with Los Angeles. He said, "I used to like it a long time ago." But, you know, if anybody has Hollywood within it as a city, he said, and hates it, which Los Angeles does, it ought to consider itself damn lucky. Without Hollywood, it would be a mail-order city. Everything in the catalogue you could get better somewhere else. But that was him being bitter because the place had changed in the many years he'd been there. People poured in, Volstead Act and Prohibition, organized crime. He said, "I was probably the first one to write about this city, and it's changed out of recognition. I know I sound like a disappointed and angry man. Well, maybe I am at that."
I wonder what he'd think of Los Angeles today. It hardly bears any resemblance to
that. No, it doesn't, no. And, I mean, his feeling was, it wasn't the fault of the city itself. He said, "It's a city no worse than others, a city rich and vigorous and full of pride, but a city lost and beaten and full of emptiness, a big, hard-boiled city with no more personality than a paper cup. Now, that's a bitter man turning on something that he loved for changing, you know?
Yeah. We're talking with Barry Day, and he's edited a marvelous book about Raymond Chandler called The World of Raymond Chandler, in his own words. Well, one of the things that shocked me in your book, Barry Day, was that Chandler only met Dashiell Hammett once.
Yeah, indeed. Although he totally admired the man, he said he could write scenes that had never been written before, unlike people like James M. Cain and most of the rest. I don't think they would have got on particularly well as people anyway, because, again, as I say, Chandler was very protective of himself, and he did that by keeping people at a distance. But when he came to write about them and put his feelings on paper, yeah, he thought this man was an original. He used to like Hemingway and went off him. And a character in one of the books is a cop, says to Marlowe, "Who is this Hemingway guy, by the way?" And Marlowe says something like, "Oh, he's a guy who keeps saying the same thing over and over again until you believe it must be important."
Is it known whether or not Hammett liked Chandler's work?
Not that I know of, no. I think he probably would have admired it, because he clearly was a man who took his art form very seriously, and that they were contemporary enough, although obviously Hammett came first. No, I think he would have liked him, yeah. But the other person that Chandler really admired was Scott Fitzgerald. Mm. And in the sense that he felt that he had charm, a very rare quality, and if he hadn't been a drinker himself, he would have done much more and much better. But he recognized the fact of somebody trying to fight down what is basically, I suppose, an illness, and still becoming an important writer in his own right. Cut down too short, too soon.
Well, The Great Gatsby is really a crime novel, isn't it?
It is, really, yeah. And it's a beautifully kind of complete, complex piece of work, and not long, and doesn't have to take endless amounts of words to tell its story. It's a wonderful miniature, I think.
It's a good book. I think we can all agree. Now, he says something interesting about learning from authors that were below him, beneath him. What does he say exactly?
I think he said that the greats are beyond reach. You can't learn from them. You don't know how they do it, and probably they don't either. But the other ones, you can see how they're doing it. And he would say Earl Stanley Gardner. He was very prolific. He said he learned his crafts, Chandler, by taking an Earl Stanley Gardner novel and then rewriting it in his own words, then going back and seeing where he'd missed something, what effect he hadn't got, and why. He learned a lot about how the things are put together by reading somebody who was a brilliant plotter in his own way and very facile. He would dictate all his books. And he said his voice became old and creaky because he spent all his time dictating into a machine.
Dictating 90 novels.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Probably more, because he wrote a bunch as A.A. Fair or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Endless pseudonyms, yes.
Chandler never did that. He never wrote under another name and hid some of his work?
Not that we know of, no. What he always had, and this came from his time at public school and in London, he did a little bit of journalism when he left public school, and he also had a feeling that he liked to write fantasy. At one point he wrote a kind of memo to himself that if things kept on going as well as they were, he'd take a year off. He and Sissy would go to London, and he would write this fantasy story, which he thought he could do pretty well. And she, who typed his correspondence, gave him back a copy with a little note on it. "Dear Romeo, I wonder if you'll find this amusing in years to come," because he never did get to write it. He wrote a couple of fantasy stories, but they weren't very good.
No. Even though his great calling was the work that he did, he looked at it as the rest of the world did, as a lesser art form?
I think he felt it was a lesser art form that he inherited, that he had done quite a bit to improve it, but he would never call it high literature. And after a while, he kind of realized that that was what he was good at, and it'd be very foolish to try something else. And, of course, as the years went by, then I think his flexibility went with it in many ways. He wrote lots of stories in the early years. I mean, his first story, Blackmailers Don't Shoot, had more dead bodies in it than all the rest of his books put together. And then he learned that you didn't need to do that. So then Marlowe comes along, because he wasn't the first detective that Chandler created. He had about half a dozen others in the short stories. But when Marlowe took off, when those stories were reprinted, and certainly when they're in a collection, John Dalmas or whoever became Philip Marlowe.
And were there significant differences in the characters that he had created than the character of Marlowe?
Well, I think he knew Marlowe. He got to know him because it was partly him. And he then absorbed himself in that. For instance, when he wrote The Long Goodbye, he wrote it, first of all, in the third person. And when he read it, he said, I couldn't get through it. It just was flat. He said, so I'm going to have to call in Mr. Marlowe. I think I'm stuck with that man for life. So that the version we've all read was the second version. By that time, he was Marlowe, Marlowe was him. Of course, Marlowe was always wisecracking, and when he used to get about $25 a day to sell with, and it went up a bit. And Marlowe says, for $50 a day, I don't get shot. That costs $75.
We're talking with Barry Day, and he's edited this wonderful book, The World of Raymond Chandler, in his own words. Chandler and I both love cats. I loved his letters about his cat. He really loved his cat.
He did, Taki, yeah. I mean, Japanese for bamboo. And he had another one later in life, because this one lived quite a long time, but the new one was exactly the same looking, so he called it by the same name. But when you read that, I put that in deliberately. It wasn't everybody's idea that fitted the book. But I said, this man had a softer side. He had a softer side because of his wife, and he had a softer side because he identified with his cat. And this shows a side of him that normally you wouldn't see. You see him as a tough guy writing about tough things and tough people, but he was a sentimentalist at heart. And there's a line which is a giveaway, I think, when he says in one of the books about Marlowe, in a letter about Marlowe, yeah, all us tough guys are sentimentalists at heart. All us tough guys. So very much I'm Marlowe, Marlowe is me, even though he wouldn't admit to it until very late in the game, I think.
How did he feel about the portrayals on film of Marlowe? There's Dick Powell. There was, of course, Humphrey Bogart. And
well, he thought Dick Powell was pretty good. That was an interesting piece of casting, because the book is called Farewell, My Lovely, as you know. But when they made it first in America, Dick Powell was known, if he was known, as a song and dance man from the 30s. So they thought Farewell, My Lovely sounds like a musical. So they changed the title to Murder, My Sweet. But in the UK, that wasn't the problem. So they called it Farewell, My Lovely. He thought he was good. But he thought Bogart was the best that he ever saw. He said, because he can be tough without a gun. There's an inherent quality in him, which is, you know, a kind of a bitterness, a questioning, taking things by no means for granted. So he liked him very much. I don't think he would have liked Elliot Gould. Robert Altman made him into a bit of a slob, I thought.
Yeah.
I didn't care for that. James Garner was okay, at least looked the part, and had that kind of wry sense of humor that Marlowe has in the books. But in a funny way, one of them who might have been the best of all came to it too late, and that was Robert Mitchum. Mm-hmm. And he was 30 years too late in the part, but in the remake of Farewell, My Lovely, he was pretty damn good, I think.
I think so.
But you know the person he wanted? He and Ian Fleming both wanted Cary Grant.
I want Cary Grant to play me also.
Yes, well, when he's finished playing me, I'll lend him to you.
Yeah, Cary Grant once went to some kind of an event, and he was signing in at the desk, and the woman said, can I have your name? And he goes, I'm Cary Grant. And she goes, you don't look like Cary Grant. He says, nobody does.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking with Barry Day, and his book is called The World of Raymond Chandler, in his own words. Are you going to do another one of these in his own words things?
I'm thinking about it. I'm not deciding yet on what it might be, because having done P.G. Woodhouse, having done Dorothy Parker, having done a lot of Coward and Oscar Wilde and so on, I've written about people who love words, because I do, and I love people who love words. So it's got to be somebody that I can identify with from that point of view. I've done books on lyricists like Johnny Mercer for the same reason. So we'll see. Meanwhile, Mr. Coward is luring me back with one or two more bits and pieces to finish off the total picture of Coward.
Well, maybe you would come back. I hope you would, and talk about Noel Coward after your next project.
Yes, I'm happy to do that. It'll come out in the summer, July.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being a guest on From the Bookshelf, Barry Day.
I enjoyed it.
That closes the book on this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Barry Day. His latest book is called The World of Raymond Chandler in His Own Words. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.